You're listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecology series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on Thursday, November 12th, with composer and sound artist Matthew Goodhart. A longtime resident of the San Francisco Bay Area, Matthew recently relocated to New York City, where he is serving as a Mellon postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University. He presented a mixed-media solo performance that combined transducer-activated metal percussion with piano and autonomously sounding instruments. But we began our evening with a conversation about his recent work and his background, and we'll begin our program right there, at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. So, to continue our evening, so welcome again, and it's been a while. So
yes.
So Matthew and I were students together years ago. At Mills College, and so now you're in New York. So tell us how you got here. You've just arrived recently.
I have just arrived. Moved here in August, mid-August. Dan and I were in Mills College together in 1994, 95?
Well, I think 96 and 97 is what I remember. I mean,
all right. I graduated in 97.
Yeah, so I came in the middle of the year is what I mean. There you go. Like January of 1996. So
I did, after Mills, I did a lot of freelance work, a lot of touring of Europe, West Coast, did not do much on the East Coast. I was saying last time I played in New York was 1999, I think.
Really? You mean between tonight
and 1999, I have not been in New York.
That's amazing.
I have been, New York has been flyover territory for me on my way to Europe.
Right.
Wow. So it's nice to come. I've been wanting to actually more recently start to establish a professional relationship with people here in New York and on the East Coast. So that's been actually great. I've done some things in Boston recently, but it's nice to connect back to New York. And then after a number of years of freelancing, with the changes in the economy and the changes in my age, I decided that freelancing wasn't going to pay for the rest of my life.
Right. So
I needed things like health insurance and so forth.
Well, when you refer to freelancing, so what? Elaborate on that. So freelancing as a pianist, is that right?
Yeah, as a teacher.
I was teaching
music and composition and improvisation at various places. Occasional adjunct faculty at Mills, some other places, as well as just pursuing the life of an artist, you know, performing, composing, releasing CDs, all these kinds of things.
But at that time, you were primarily a pianist, right?
Yeah.
Or at least in your touring of Europe and so on, that was as a pianist, is that right?
Yeah, mostly. I actually, when Dan knew me, I did a lot of free jazz. I was playing with Glenn Spearman, a great tenor saxophone player. I worked a little bit with Cecil Taylor, with Adelio Smith, sort of this strong jazz-influenced improvisational music stream.
Right.
After Glenn's death, I got a little more interested in timbral music and creating sort of sound spaces that were didn't use the same type of language that tradition of free jazz used.
Right.
And so I was on two. I had sort of developed these things of certain piano techniques and getting sort of certain resonance out of the instrument. And I tried to bring that into some of my improvisational groups and construct pieces that would do that, and
right.
I wasn't very satisfied with that. So I was on tour in Turkey, actually, and got invited to the International Festival of Spectral Music to perform. So I went to that and got reintroduced, really, to the music of Tristan Mirai and Gerard Griset and Ianco Dumitrescu, and sort of found a compositional similarity with what, how they were constructing their harmonic contexts and the relationship between structure and harmony that I was doing in improvisation. I wasn't interested in exactly the same aesthetics as them, but that did push me into a more compositional direction. So on that tour, which was in 2003, I started to compose, and I wrote some studies for string quartet and some other things. And that got me more interested in composition. So when I came back from that, I started doing more and more composing. I composed a string quartet and started to use technology to analyze sound in order to get into the details of sound.
So in the way that the spectralists are involved with sound?
Yeah. Slightly different aesthetic, but some of the same tools.
But using the sonic properties of sound to sort of extract form and structure of larger compositions.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It fit with my improvisation slightly different from what the spectralists are into, which is taking a sort of absolute sound and then modeling it in a group of instruments, taking the sound of a single instrument and modeling it with a group of instruments. I was interested, my improvisations had taken this turn of, I was doing a lot of inside the piano work, a lot of scraping of the strings, plucking, doing harmonics,
timbral things.
And as I moved from instrument to instrument on these tours, I discovered that the makeup, the build of the piano, each piano is very different.
Sure.
So with these hand-built instruments, what your sonic possibilities of the instrument were changed each night. And so each improvisation became an exploration of the acoustic properties of that instrument. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this was the sort of aesthetic and philosophical basis that I started to take into using computers to assist in music composition and production. That I was looking for things that would target the unique acoustics of each instrument.
Right. I see. So this is in the early 2000s. So at some point, if I'm understanding the chronology, at some point you went back to school. You enrolled at UC Berkeley. Is that right? So
Was
it around that time?
It was around that time, yeah. It had to do with desiring to get more, to push my compositional chops up to where my improvisation chops were. To meet with some of the great minds at UC Berkeley, like David Wessel.
And there's a bit of a spectral music history there, is there not? I mean, I know that Gerard Griset was there, right?
Griset was there in the 80s.
And there's been a lasting sort of legacy of that.
Absolutely.
And certainly as a center of composition, there's some influence just because of the dominance of the spectrals.
Well, there's a huge amount of French influence there.
Right, well, that's what I'm
There's
thinking.
A good interchange with IRCOM, which, for those of you who don't know, is the Paris-based center for computer music research.
So you were drawn into the Berkeley.
I was drawn into that. Also, as I said, getting older, needing health insurance, all that kind of stuff, touching in on academia, having a PhD might not be a bad thing to start to head into my 40s and 50s.
And that took how long? I mean, from say, what, 2004? Or?
No, I went in 2008.
Oh,
yeah.
So the moment you're describing in your tour of Turkey and
that was 2003.
So that was sort of the beginning of this new direction.
Of this compositional direction.
Which took... The next step was going back to Berkeley in 2008.
Yeah, after doing a bunch of compositions, a bunch of exploration, and realizing, hey, some people get PhDs for doing this.
Right.
Maybe I should pursue that. Yeah.
So while at Berkeley, so were you primarily involved at SynMat, or were you in the composition program, or a little of both? Were you writing scores on paper, or
I was doing both. Right. I was doing both.
And who were you studying with in the composition area?
I worked with a lot of different people there. In the composition area, I worked with Ed Campion a little bit, with Frank Madrassian a bit, but my dissertation advisor was Ken Wayno. Mm-hmm. So I worked most closely with him.
I think.
And I did work with David Wessel quite a bit over at SynMat, too.
Right.
My dissertation piece didn't use technology. My dissertation piece was a large ensemble, 17 instruments, but like the stuff I do tonight, I'm interested in space. So I broke the ensemble up into four different choirs and had the audience sit on stage in the middle, surrounded by the instruments. So that's it. Similar to this, even though there wasn't technology involved.
So the time at Berkeley, you spent, what, 4 years there? Or?
Five years? Yeah, and that's where I developed this project with the gongs that's going to be the basis for most of the things tonight.
So it's still pretty fresh, I guess. I mean, it's been a few years, but... So subsequent to Berkeley, mm-hmm. How did that change? Are you back to freelancing, or you're in academia? Obviously, I know that you're here in New York on mm-hmm. postdoc. Right?
Yes.
So that's, I guess, maybe a stepping stone somewhere. I don't know. So tell me a little bit. I'm not really totally up to speed on what is a postdoc. Maybe you can help me understand.
A postdoc is essentially it's like in between being a graduate student and being a professor.
Right.
It's just a time to continue your research, essentially.
Right. Or in this case, your work, your composition.
Exactly.
Your experiments.
Yeah, it's all based on this stuff with the gongs, which was, even though that wasn't what my official dissertation piece was,
right.
This stuff with the gongs and this technology
right.
Was a good chunk of my work at Berkeley. So I'm basically continuing that now.
I see. So you were developing these same tools that you're mm-hmm. presenting tonight at Huawei. I guess that was more of a SynMed kind of a mm-hmm. adventure. But they weren't your actual project or your final project, but
Berkeley is really, it's very loose in a good, very, very good way for composers there, that they're not necessarily interested in the way that you would in, say, a science degree or something, of coming up with one specific research direction that defines the rest of your career. They're very happy for you to push yourself in different directions, and I think most composers or musical artists these days tend to have many different faces of
sure.
Compositional work. There's installations. Most composers do installations now.
Sure.
Lots of them do electronic work as well as acoustic work, as well
That's
as
right.
improvising.
That's right.
So they're sort of
That's
open
important.
To that, which
yeah.
is really nice.
Right. Well, so how did you arrive at this particular sort of setup, as it were, with the gongs and the cymbals and the? I guess what you're doing, just in its mm-hmm. simplest description, where you're activating these symbols with some piezos and mm-hmm. some signal that you're sending to it. I mean, well, how did you get from piano and paired piano and spectral composition to these tools? I mean, what was the catalyst?
Well, it was a way of investigating the acoustic properties of these symbols, these specific instruments.
Right.
So that's what the tools I developed there do. What each of these instruments has attached to the back of them, except for these two up here that I'm performing on, is a little transducer called a sound exciter that's essentially like a loudspeaker, mm-hmm. like you have for your stereo, but it doesn't have the cone attached to it. So whatever it attaches to, it turns into the surface of the speaker.
Right.
And they were designed initially for cheap car audio systems so that you could put a whole bunch of speakers in your car, and for cheap surround sound systems for 5.1, 7.1, et cetera, for right. your DVD player. But a lot of artists have been using these now. So these are the basis, the fact that I can send a signal into these instruments is sort of the basis of the idea. So what I've done is I've done an acoustic analysis of each instrument. So I know its whole partial spectrum. I have 120 different partials mapped out for each instrument that I can then take into the computer and either assign a sine tone to each of those partials and get the instrument to activate. Not dissimilar to the way a singer can break a glass on the other side of the room because she hits it with the resonating frequency. It's the same. I don't break the cymbals, hopefully, right. but it's the same idea.
Right.
And then I also have resonant models that I can create inside the computer of a subset of those partials in the instrument, and then stimulate those with noise or different types of samples.
Right.
You'll hear some bird calls, things like that. And then you can shift from one subset of, like if this cymbal has, say, 100 partials, you can design a model with 20 partials and then another one with 20 different ones and then another with another 20 different ones. And you can morph from one model to the next. So it's like you get these smaller symbols, simpler symbols that are within the body of the original symbol and get all these different kinds of sounds. And then there's also sample manipulation. I record myself playing them, striking them, rubbing them, scraping them.
But was there an experience or a moment that drew you to these particular instruments, I'm trying to imagine how the idea emerged, you know, given the story that we're
So I had been doing a lot with the pianos and striking and plucking and all that kind of stuff, and then one of the really amazing things about metal percussion instruments is that even though two gongs, we hear them as gongs, if you do an analysis of them, they're radically different from each other.
Sure.
They have all sorts of different types of sound, smaller sounds within them. So I decided, like, how can I investigate that part of metal percussion? And I started out, like, putting one in the middle of a room and trying to bombard it with all sorts of loud sine waves and had a lot of failures that sounded terrible. Until it was actually someone who recommended to me. He says, "Oh, have you tried these things?
These sound exciters?
These little sound exciters." And I didn't know about them.
So kind of a common, commercially available.
Yeah, $20 each at Parts Express.
Parts Express. I know Parts Express.
Yes, we all do.
Sound exciters. So they just require some electricity, or do they battery powered, or what? How do they
work? No, they're like a speaker, so they're powered by the amplifier.
So you're sending from your amp, you're sending your speaker cable, basically.
Yeah, there's a bunch of speaker cable all.
And it's all going directly to the sound exciters.
Yes.
Okay. So it's like one of those little piezo discs. It's a part of that family.
It's part of that family.
But it's a particular development in that.
Specifically designed for pushing out sound and complex sound.
So your investigation of the symbols was just kind of part of. One of the things you were exploring as you were exploring more broadly timbral analysis, it sounds like, that you were using them as a tool to analyze in the way maybe you were also analyzing other instruments at that time.
Yeah, and I still do. I mean, there's some transducers on the piano, on the viola here. There's also the physical aspect of it I'm really, really interested in.
Right.
This notion of what is an instrument. When you watch a really great musician, instrumental musician, there's a feeling that the person's body and the instrument are extensions of each other.
Right.
And I just kind of became fascinated by that these, you know, musicians will talk about instruments is like having a spirit or having a particular quality.
Right.
My old piano teacher used to describe his Steinway piano as this beautiful old crone that, you know, kept teaching him.
Right.
And I always had that feeling. I mean, you're always learning from the instrument, and playing really good instruments makes you a better player because you're learning. There's something about it. It has an exterior nature to you.
Right.
Yet at the same time, there are these inanimate objects that are sort of out there, and the only spirit they have is really what we perceive of them. It's sort of a projection as well.
Right.
So this sort of interface between the notion of an instrument being this sort of other also drove that. I mean, like, everyone walks in and looks at the gong, and it's always like, the gong.
Right.
You know, it's like, what is that? I don't know what that is, but it's really fascinating.
Right. Well, actually, to take it one step further, I mean, as you explained to me earlier, that this gong actually has a name.
Yes.
So it has a spirit in your world. What is the name?
Dominique.
This is Dominique.
Yes.
The gong. So that's taking this idea, to another level, I guess. So Dominique certainly has a spirit, right? Or a presence. Or
and
something.
As I work with each of these instruments, I get to know them better and better. And it's interesting, like, when I tour Europe, obviously I can't bring this, so I'm provided instruments by other people over there, and part of the process becomes getting to know this new instrument and how does it change these pieces that are set up in certain ways.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Well, good. Well, so tonight then, you're kind of combining a bunch of things. I mean, you have all the instruments that you're mm-hmm. activating with the sound exciters, and but also piano.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the as a performance? I, mm-hmm. I guess would you would call what we're going to do tonight a performance? Yes.
I think so.
But it's also an installation to some extent, right?
I'm also fascinated by this sort of nature of performance, like this mm-hmm. sort of ritual that we all undergo, like everyone's looking at me and right. I do these things up there and there's this sort of right. ritualistic sacred space up there.
Sure.
And we listen to things in a certain way when you're listening to a string quartet or you're listening to bodies standing up there performing. Mm-hmm. When you walk into a sound installation, you experience the sound in a different way. You're not expecting the same rapidity of movement of sound necessarily. You're not expecting the same kind of potentially narrative structure. And I'm fascinated in moving between these different types of listening spaces. I mean, it's certainly a lot of artists have explored those, but it's just my way of dealing with it, I guess.
Right. So we could consider tonight a kind of a hybrid, or
yeah.
So
I like to think of it
so
as
would
a
you
hybrid.
Would you invite the audience to move around as if
you
they
need
were
to.
In a gallery, which I guess in a sense we are in a gallery.
Yeah.
But
no. Go ahead.
I'm just curious how you perceive it and how you would expect it to be received. I guess is what I'm saying.
In some ways, I'm still experimenting with it.
Right.
So
right.
feedback is great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are, the first piece, for example, is performed. The second piece is installation-like, so I will walk off the stage.
Nice.
I mean, my feeling for people is if you need to move around, you want to move around,
mm-hmm.
feel free to move around.
Right.
I mean, I just had a big discussion with a graduate student from Columbia who was listening to this really long, slow piece, and he said he hated it. And I said, but do you like sound installations that do the same thing? And he's like, yeah, because then I can move around and I can lie down. And,
right.
and I was like, well, why don't, I don't know, we didn't put any blankets on the floor or anything, but like, why do we have to sit
right.
still at a performance?
Right.
So,
well, there are
and the other thing I'll mention is that the pieces tonight all run from one into the next.
Okay. So it's continuous.
So it's a continuous concert, which I guess I had just seen this really interesting performer, Simone Steen Anderson, at the Miller Theater recently. It was a great, great evening, and a lot of technology in his work. And he went straight through, you know, from piece to piece to piece.
Nice.
And I had done this again last summer, and I was like, oh, I guess this is a thing now, you know. I think it's one of those possibilities that using technology in this way makes possible, so it's
right.
a logical next step.
Right.
And one that I took, I hadn't seen anyone else do it before, but I guess he's doing it, and I'm sure that means that there's hundreds of people out there doing it as well. So,
excellent.
That's how it's going to go.
Okay. Good. Well, I'm excited to get to it. I just have a couple more things
sure.
I want to ask you about. So, I did want to know a little bit
mm-hmm.
about the technology. I mean, of course, we've talked about, you know, the sound activation and everything,
mm-hmm.
but what's behind the scenes? Are there any particular tools that you're using on the computer or otherwise that
yeah.
are of note?
Well, most of the things are programmed in Max.
Okay.
Max MSB, a
sure.
lot of people use that. There's actually a sort of, if there's any computer programmer geeks in here, there's a sub-language called ODOT that was developed at SynMat that I use quite a bit.
ODOT.
It's really powerful. So that's a little more, I mean, Max is fun because I came to it as a non-programmer. So the idea of having a box that does one thing and then another box that does other things, and you can draw a line from one to the next, it's like,
wow,
that's intuitive to me. I understand that. You know, I wasn't trained in computer
right.
science.
Well,
but
yeah.
as you start to do that more and more, you start to see how things are going, and you're starting to understand how code works, and that becomes kind of awkward. And this ODOT language allows you to do a lot of processing of data. Very efficiently using OSC packages, and then send it around the patch in a very efficient and sort of elegant way. And I found it to be very, very powerful. And it was written by a friend of mine, which is awesome. So
does it integrate with Max? Or
yeah, it integrates with both Max and PD.
Okay.
So I recommend that. I've done some things in Open Music, Lisp.
That's also a Sinmat development, right?
So, no. Open Music is from Earcom.
Earcom, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
And also Spear, which is an analysis program that was generated by Columbia a number of years ago. Audio Sculpt a little bit, which is also an Earcom piece of software. Okay. So yeah, there's a lot of that.
I got it. Okay. Great. So that's a lot of stuff. And I guess Sinmat was a good source for getting up to speed with that.
It was good. I mean, it's a real collaborative thing there. I mean, everything that I'm doing here, it's not just me.
Right.
John McCallum, who's a good friend of mine and a great composer, designed the program that does the analysis. And then he also wrote ODOT. And then, you know, we've traded compositional ideas. So music is always a collaboration.
Right.
And so the guys at Sinmat are really good at that part of it.
Great. Well, great. Well, thank you. So the one other thing, this is an ongoing thread here on musical ecologies, and that's geography, location, and certainly California, New York, having myself lived in California and now living in New York. So I'm always curious to dig a little deeper into California, given that you're from California.
Yes.
You are a Bay Area native, right?
Born and raised, most of my life.
From Marin County, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, I was born in San Francisco, but raised in Marin.
That's what I remember. I remember visiting you. Was it in Kentfield?
No, you probably came out to Fairfax.
Fairfax, right. Okay, that's
used to
next
be a
to
big, Kentfield. Good hippie holdout. I don't know if it still is. But
Fairfax has still some good hippies.
Still some good hippies there. Yeah, it's really very pure hippies. They're just wonderful.
Well, so I guess what I'm getting at, or what I'm curious about, I mean, now you're in New York, and of course you've just gotten here, but it's worth noting also you did spend some time in New York earlier in your life. Right? Mm-hmm. Didn't you do some undergraduate study here years ago?
Yes, I was there in New York for 2 years, which is where I met all of these three people. I was a theater major, actually. At NYU for 2 years.
What, in early 90s?
This was 86 to 89.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I know. It was very different New York then.
New York.
I left theater because I was... At some point, I came to the incredible realization that I was a terrible actor. But I was even doing sound work then. I was doing sound design for some of the shows.
Right.
At NYU and so forth. So leaving to realizing I needed to know music better.
Right.
And also I wanted to get a liberal arts degree. So I actually ended up at UC Berkeley and got an English degree.
That was before you went to Mills?
That was before Mills.
Oh, okay. So your recent stint was your second stint at Berkeley.
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
It was a return. Yes.
That's great. Right. So I guess, I don't mean to make any big deal of it, but, it's when we do have a Californian in the house, it's always interesting to touch on California, the differences, what do you miss about it, or how do you feel about the two? I mean, it's kind of a polarity still. I mean, I don't know that it's so strong now, New York, California, West Coast music, East Coast music, uptown, downtown, all of it is kind of dissolved to a certain extent, but I still miss the California myself, although I'm not a native, so I always felt a little bit like a visitor, but I still miss it. So I don't know. I guess any thoughts?
Interesting. California is great. Bay Area is great in particular. There's such a great group of artists there that are mutually supportive, and some of them are really, really world class. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You go to Greg Goodsman's house and sit in his living room and he'll do these kind of theatrical musical performances that are as good as anything I have seen anywhere.
Wow.
And there's a number of people like that are out there. Frustrations with the Bay Area are that, art scene is what?
It's far away.
It's far away. It can be very isolated. There's also in the last 15 years, the arts coverage has degraded tremendously, which is really tragic.
You mean in the press? You mean.
In the press, right. There was a sort of renaissance there while you were at Mills in the 90s. That's when Glenn Spearman was doing his things. There was a bunch of music venues. There was some press coverage in the independent newspapers, blah, blah, blah. All of those independent newspapers got bought out.
Right.
A friend of mine who had written beautiful articles in the Chronicle on Paul Plimley and Glenn and a bunch of other ones, was told they don't want him to do that anymore.
Right.
Cover only the San Francisco Jazz Festival.
It happens everywhere, right?
Exactly. It's part of that same thing.
Sure.
It's just a smaller community there now. So there's a strange feeling of being in the way. Being in the way as an artist there. I started to think about that recently.
Being in the way of
what's happening. Yeah. I mean, it's all been essentially, it's being colonized.
It's the technology of the world.
Yeah. And there's limited housing, there's limited everything else. So a bunch of people, goofball people making weird sounds who need these sort of empty spaces are not something that's valued.
Right.
And it's a struggle anywhere, but I think it's taking a particular toll on the Bay Area scene now. I mean, the artists are still there, and they're still great, and they're still doing things.
Right.
And I hear great music there and great art, but finding it is just hard,
right.
You know?
Right. Well, so do you anticipate going back there? I mean, so you're here for 2 years, right?
For 2 years, but I don't know after that.
Right.
I mean, I'm not particularly drawn toward going back.
You didn't sell your house or wherever.
I know.
Well, so you don't have any. There's nothing specifically.
Pulling me back.
No,
I have family there, so I'll always be going back and seeing them. But and of course a great community, which I'll plan to keep going back and staying a part of. But no, I'm not. It's not like I'm only here for 2 years and then heading back.
Right.
Depends on what happens
when
I'm done with Columbia.
Can happen, for sure.
But my goal is to stay East Coast.
I see. Okay. Good to know.
That's the idea.
Well, good. Well, we're very excited to host you.
And that was my conversation with composer and sound artist Matthew Goodhart. The evening continued with a solo performance that included transducer-activated percussion instruments, piano, and something that Matthew describes as autonomously sounding instruments. Let's listen now to Matthew Goodhart performing Bracken Tongues Wept and Other Works at the Old Stone House on Thursday, November 12th, 2015. You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.